So this section is on governance, and when we look at the topic we're dealing with in this conference, risk and uncertainty, in the context of governance, we're doing more than putting it in its institutional environment. We're also getting the opportunity to, I think, identify some crucial dynamics inside the methodologies and the apparently most fundamental cognitive ways of dealing with concepts of risk and uncertainty. And in particular, to kind of summarise it, I think it's about the dynamics of power. So I'm going to speak about how those dynamics play out in ways that follow on quite explicitly from Melissa Leach's talk, which I'm assuming everyone heard, and I'll just follow up to take that for granted to begin with. So my bottom line then, to spoil what slightly sad melodrama there is about this, is to come to a conclusion that these set-piece antagonisms and dichotomies between rationality and progress on the one hand, and precaution and democracy, emotional issues on the other hand, is actually a false dichotomy. And when we start looking at it through the lens of the way power operates in conditioning knowledge and the way it makes us think and act about risk, we can see how those things might in fact be reconciled. So I'll go through, first of all, talking about some of the implications of the missing politics of knowledge about risk, and then the missing politics of technology, and end up with some rather purple phrases at the end, which I hope you forgive me for. Okay. So thinking now about Lord Krebs's very engaging talk last night, I'm going to just say a few words about the role of sound science in risk governance. Because when political processes, and I'm identifying individuals here, just as to make it a little bit more colourful, although there's not a lot of diversity in this selection, which tells you a lot about something else about the process. But when politicians, decision makers, find themselves beleaguered by these big set-piece controversies over risk, they routinely find themselves referring to sound science, evidence-based practices, science-based decision-making, as a means to resolve the issues they're dealing with. So we see this on GM foods, on chemicals, on energy, even, interestingly, on nuclear weapons, where science-based decisions are invoked as a definitive authority for the decisions that should or will be taken. And what's going on here, and I think it was illustrated very well by John Krebs's talk last night, was highlighted going way back now, three decades, the work of David Collingridge, and before that Habermas, of course, and others, but processes of decision justification. We speak of these things as if they're about this concept called risk, because that's a decent, polite thing to do. But everybody knows that it's as much about justifying decisions, no matter how. Risk rhetoric is one way of doing it, risk analysis is one way of doing it, but there are other ways of doing it which equally suffice. Military power, for instance, or aristocratic rights in different contexts have been used in the same way. So to justify decisions, and also to manage blame in the event it all turns to worms. So that you're not sat there exposed to the responsibility for something going wrong. You can say, well, don't blame me. I was only doing what I was told by this process, be it an analytical process or a deliberative process or even a participatory process. And when Lord Krebs last night talked about the inconvenience of the pesticides case, again, I'm assuming everyone was there, that dynamic played out very largely, and the malleability of the Badger's case, that he felt that, despite what he regarded very persuasively as being fairly clear, prescriptive conclusions from his analysis, it was nonetheless possible, he said at the end of his talk, that one might go to that same body of evidence and concoct a science-based case for different interventions. So this kind of science-based rhetoric is basically about justification. It's about converting the messy, intractable political problems into neat technical puzzles. In other words, that's a reference to Kuhnian idea of what constitutes science, ironically then, being quite consistent with science at that. Now, in dealing with some of the dynamics here, this is the chart that Melissa showed yesterday. Was it yesterday? Yes, it was yesterday. Taking the basic parameters of risk to identify these other ideal types, based on work of people going back to Frank Knight, economists like Shackle and Keynes, David Collingridge, Smithson, Rabbits, Brian Wynne, and many others, but representing it graphically, and she showed how it is that institutions and discourses in governance, not in the methods, serve to narrow down, to confine the way we think about these things and discuss them and act on them into that domain of risk at the top left. It's an example of what Ulrich Beck called organised irresponsibility, because what's happening is the consequences of the neglect of these more intractable parameters out here fall on those who are exposed to the events if they occur. So responsibility is not being taken for dealing with these more intractable forms of incomplete knowledge. And again, last night, without implying any criticism, Lord Krebs illustrated this kind of dynamic in his very candid way of talking about the processes, because although his talk was on risk, uncertainty, equally, in fact he spoke about quantification overwhelmingly. He was using numerical characterizations of the risks he was dealing with up in that top left box, and only when he came to the case of the pesticides and the RCEP versus the Advisory Committee on Pesticides, he moved into a situation under which it wasn't possible to reconcile. And it's interesting that in that case, the body that actually did the exposing of the uncertainty, the RCEP, has in fact now bitten the dust. So that scheme for representing this kind of dynamics in the way we think we're talking about risk, we're actually talking about far broader things, and the way we represent risk is conditioned by these broader processes. That scheme just used the two axes of outcomes and possibilities, because those are the axes under which the formal technical definition of risk works. You can cut the pie in all sorts of different ways, of course. That's a way to try and be as effective in communication as possible to folk who are more used to thinking in that way. This is an attempt to go through a series of other ways in which we can identify the missing politics of knowledge in the way we conventionally govern risk. And in fact, in ways in which we suppress our knowledge about knowledge, things we actually know very well about knowledge, are suppressed in this process of reduction. And I put these quite starkly and a little bit simplistically in the hope of being stimulating or controversial. The first one you could call insufficiency. That we know, and it follows from a work of philosophers, I'm not a philosopher, but many philosophers have written on these matters, that the efficacy of knowledge, the fact you know, can do, you know how to do something, does not constitute a normative justification for action. So, for instance, in neuroscience, the fact that we're now beginning to glimpse the possibility of ways of what is called enhancing, one might also say corrupting, human faculties in various ways, just because we can do it doesn't mean we should do it. The key issue is, should we do it? Know-how is less important in such contexts than know-why. And yet our regulatory institutions and practices and discourses around risk are all about, the assumption is, if you can do it, then basically you should do it, unless it's unsafe in some rather specific fashion. Another dilemma is incompleteness, in a different sense, in that the knowledge that allows us to make something work is typically not sufficiently complete to allow us to understand the wider effects. So the unknowns are as important as the knowns. And this goes back to Lao Tzu and Socrates, who talked about knowing one's ignorance is the best part of knowledge. Again, fairly sort of live strand in our thinking about knowledge, but not in risk governance. So in the area of nanohealth, for instance, the fact that we can manufacture substances that are designed at the nanoscale doesn't, and in order to perform particular functions, which we can do effectively, and we're beginning to do that increasingly, impressively in various areas, doesn't mean that knowledge is sufficient to understand the consequences more widely. It just tells us about that functionality, and sometimes not fully about that. Indeterminacy, that where we have effective knowledge, that doesn't preclude surprise. And this is a crucial point, because the chart that I just showed, and Melissa showed earlier, can encourage us, as somebody picked up in discussion, to think of it as a taxonomy. Is this case in this box or this box? Now, when Donald Rumsfeld talked about the known knowns, if we think of them in the domain of the known knowns, it fosters a kind of hubris, where we're particularly exposed to the possibility of being wrong about the assignment. And so the point here is that we are nowhere more exposed to the consequences of surprise than when we think we're not exposed to surprise. And examples like halogenated hydrocarbons, endocrine disrupting chemicals, are examples of things where, chlorofluorocarbons were identified as industrial products because it was actively thought they were benign in, by comparison with the things they were substituting. Because the mechanism through which these chlorofluorocarbons degrade stratospheric ozone simply weren't anticipated. Likewise, endocrine disrupting chemicals were benign in terms of other toxicological vectors, but the endocrine disruption mechanism, this mechanical coordination of molecules, simply wasn't contemplated in toxicology right up until really the 90s. So we should beware even when we're in the domain of what we think of as the known knowns. I'm sorry about this word, inversity. It's just bringing out a point Einstein, for instance, made clear in his famous metaphor of the circle of knowledge. That increased knowledge, increasing knowledge can increase ignorance. And time again in risk regulation, we hear that, well, we'll do further research, the implication being, and then we will be more confident that we know more. As the area of Einstein's circle of knowledge increases, so the perimeter goes up. And so we have a limited analogy there, illustrating how it can be that knowledge can increase and yet the ignorance increase as well. So an example of that is nonlinear dynamics. The discovery of nonlinear dynamics, complexity and so forth, made us aware of an exposure to ignorance that we hadn't anticipated before in the way that deterministic systems can operate. Another principle of this kind is intractability. And this is the point brought out by Brian Wynn, but other people have pointed to it as well, Jack Lalula and others, that our knowledge of risks don't just sit there in a vacuum, we act on them. We build infrastructures, we build institutions on the basis of that. And when we do so, we compound our commitments to that body of knowledge. That means we tend to think in certain ways, slightly protectively about it, we resist revelations that it's somehow inadequate. It also means that when we find we're exposed to surprise, this is a very tangible kind of impact on the institutions themselves. So what really matters with ignorance is not just the existence of ignorance, but the exposure to the unknown. How exposed are we? If we build an infrastructure on the back of endocrine disrupting chemical supply chains, or nuclear power, or renewable energy, depending on what it is that's incurring the salient ignorance in retrospect, the more we commit to it, the more we are exposed. And we can't ignore that as a really crucial factor around ignorance. And then finally, there's incommensurability. The assumption is that if you gather together, and often it's the kind of more deliberative side of the debate that emphasizes this, the more different knowledges you get together, the greater the sum. So knowledges are basically additive. But we know they're not additive. We know that you can bring different knowledges together. I was on a science committee at one point where the molecular biologists and the ecologists came together, and those knowledges certainly were not additive. They subtracted from one another in various important ways. They often conflict, and of course that expands even more when you move into the domain of lay knowledge, the knowledge of farmers or of consumers. This plays out in the very sort of colourful domain of GM crops, for instance. So these are all ways in which our conventional assumptions, absolutely central to the regulation of risk, are in fact false. They are misunderstandings and misrepresentations of knowledge. So to build then on the chart that Melissa showed, one practical way of addressing this is to bring out from the basement or wherever she was, the Cinderella methods that exist and are practiced, but don't tend to get the attention they deserve when it comes to the wider governance of risk. Quantitative methods as well as qualitative. It's very fashionable, and I'm a protagonist of this, to talk about participatory methods and deliberative processes and so on, and they are, as I'll come to in a second, very important. But we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Sensitivity analysis, sensitivity testing, routinely done in modelling, but not generally done when modelling meets policymaking, with a few exceptions that we've been, I know, talking about here, is one example. Interval analysis. Uncertainty heuristics of various kinds, which we again have been talking about here. Scenarios, backcasting from particular visions, interactive modelling, social elicitation techniques, Q method is a very interesting technique, which is also quantitative, representing different ways of thinking in society, not based on individuals, but based on discourses. And of course, participatory deliberation. And being more humble about what we can say about knowledge, not giving these precise figures, sometimes three, four, or five significant figures, as we sometimes see in presentations from leading risk regulators, putting more attention on monitoring and surveillance as well as modelling, because sometimes modelling is a more sexy subject, gets you better scientific credentials quite often, forgive me for simplifying things, and monitoring and surveillance sometimes get left behind. But they're crucial under ignorance. Targeted research, it seems obvious, but the BSE story was characterised by a persistent refusal to conduct research that might have been embarrassing for a period of a decade. Not putting all your eggs in one basket, having a diversity of different trajectories or research lines that one follows. Resilience, we heard a lot about on the first day, learning, adaptability and so on. These are quite practical things you can do, which you don't see the value of until you appreciate the importance of ignorance. So essentially then, the conflict between the rationality of risk assessment and the so-called emotiveness of precaution just breaks down. They're equally science-based. This is a science-based understanding based on the same parameters. Precaution simply means a readiness to take seriously these less tractable domains of knowledge. And this has been written about in various places, but just to drive home the point, precaution then is not just about managing risks, you know, being ready to ban things, as sometimes people think, or phase them out, or impose stringent liability. These management practices are relevant to precaution, but it's also, precaution is also about appraisal. It's also complementary to risk assessment, in that it enjoins us to think harder about the scope of analysis, broaden it out to cumulative synergistic effects, be more humble about what the science can tell us, look at proxies for harm like mobility, persistence, bioaccumulation. These are not harmful in themselves, but in the event that there's a surprise, we learn something about our exposure by looking at them. Be deliberate about the levels of proof, the burden of proof, who has to resource the process. Consider different the pros and cons of different options, so it's not about just saying, is this safe enough, or tolerable, or not worse than the worst other thing I can think of, which is what a lot of the science advisory committees do, but look at relative ordering of different options. Involve different groups, and involve civil society as well. These are all ways in which you can broaden out appraisal. And so avoid this narrow notion of risk. But somewhere into my talk, I noticed that I'm still talking about the constraints rather than the opportunities of technology. I'm still in that kind of Beck-style risk domain, even though I've tried to broaden it out. So now I want, in the final part of my talk, to look at that second consequence, looking forward as prospectively about the possibilities of technology. And that's why my title was From Risk Regulation to Innovation Governance, because it really, in order to be systematic and comprehensive about risk in these ways, I think we need to take account of the dynamics of technology as well as science. And here again, I start with some of the received wisdoms in high-level policy debates about technology. Essentially, that all innovation is good, undifferentiated, usually spoken about, you know, pro-innovation policies, the Lisbon strategy, the organising now sort of leitmotif of the European Union, the project for the Union, is around this pro-innovation strategy. And lamenting anti-technology critics. Whenever a favoured technology is criticised, it's not engaged with as a concern for the particular technology, it's engaged with, by and large, in these high-level debates, as anti-technology. This is the Deputy Director of the United Nations. And the need to establish a pro-technology culture. It's like saying we want to, when encountering criticisms of policy in an area of health or criminal justice, a politician saying, well, this isn't good enough. We need a pro-policy culture. You're just being anti-policy. It's a sort of hegemonic kind of way of dealing with criticism, which is not very satisfactory. So even, and I don't mean to be negative here, but even in Barack Obama's inaugural speech, we see this same kind of language about restoring science to its rightful place, partly referring to the need, and for a very good reason in that context, for a science element in decision-making. By the way, what I'm saying here is not in any way critical of science. It's the way the science is used in these kinds of debates. An individual here at Cambridge, president of the Royal Academy of Engineering, Sir Albert Broers, Lord Broers, I should say, characterised in a really great set of talks for the BBC, the Reef Lectures, that history is a race to advanced technology. So this linear notion, although we're used to saying, well, we know we've moved beyond the linear idea of where technology comes from, it's still very alive and well in these high-level discourses. that technology can be spoken of as a homogenous thing. There are no salient distinctions, effectively then no alternatives, no room for politics, because there's no choice. And so the scope of debate in these risk domains tends to focus on yes or no to some particular contingent thing that has to be being proposed by an influential actor, yes or no to that, which then by proxy is yes or no to technology, and we then, if we're being sort of cautious, we say, well, how much of this can we do, how fast, and we're always concerned about who's leading, always on this one-track kind of model of what progress is about. And we're not asking questions. And of course, this is a generalisation. I'm not saying these questions never get asked. They manifestly do. But they don't get asked in institutions and discourses at the centre of risk governance and innovation governance about which way. What are the alternatives? Says who and why? So just to elaborate on that, because I've put it quite starkly to try and make my point clear. Of course, the linear model is not... It has a more sophisticated form, which is of this kind, where it's acknowledged that technology typically begins with diverse starting points, but it's a process of optimization through sound science, through material constraints, through technical standards, through market equilibrium. We converge to some kind of optimal configuration for a technology and its associated institutions over time. And so the methods and institutions of risk regulation are aids to this optimization. They are focusing on the different modalities for implementing some incumbent pathway. So how should we implement nuclear? How should we implement GM? How should we implement human enhancement through neurotechnologies? How should we do this rather than what are the alternatives and what are the different trajectories that we might embark on? Now, what's interesting about that is it is not an evidence-based understanding of innovation. Because although they argue with each other endlessly, all the different disciplines who are concerned with trying to understand the process of innovation and technology change agree that it is basically the other way around. That in fact, from any given starting point, they typically branch out many equally possible, technically feasible or socially viable innovation pathways. I'm not saying anything goes. I'm saying there are typically a number of different ways in which we can go forward. So the best pathway, choosing that and identifying it, is not about optimization, it's about political choice. And in fact, there's a sense in which it's these choices that are... I won't go to this point because it's more technical than I can manage and still finish and keep my allotted time. So I'll stick with this point. Now, why does this matter? Because there are a diversity of processes, social processes, institutional processes, the action of power, which close down the directions of change. Now, economics has identified President Lock-in, homeostasis. I won't go into these. These are just some of the seminal authors over the last two or three decades who've looked at this. Path dependence, momentum in large technological systems. The philosophers have talked about entrapment, the way the government gets entrapped into particular technologies. Forms processes of closure and alignment, and the social scientists have talked about the role of expectations, how what we expect feeds back into what we do and becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where things could have gone other ways, driven by our imaginations of different possible futures. Now, this all seems rather abstruse and highfalutin, but the fact, for instance, that I'm here and had all this trouble at the beginning working on a bit of Windows software is an example of how we do get locked in to manifestly suboptimal configuration. Sorry, I said that with slightly more intensity than I intended. And also exposed myself to the prospect of legal action. But the QWERTY keyboard, just to pick again on my computer. The QWERTY keyboard is a mid-19th century mechanical, parameter determined the design of the QWERTY keyboard. Despite the fact it's implicated in RSI and other problems, we just can't get out of it. Same is true of military systems, of light water reactors, narrow gauge railways, the urban automobile, the internal combustion engine rather than other possible propulsion technologies for the automobile. The VHS Betamax standoff of the late 70s, early 80s is famous. Media standards in other sorts of consumer products, even in competitive markets, we find ourselves locking in. So deliberately or blindly, societies are choosing which paths they go down and which not. So the stakes are very high. we are foregoing entire possible futures when we make these commitments. And that's the difference between this understanding of technology change and the prevailing linear one-track one. So, looking forward then, we see this same kind of thing playing out with big choices like over sustainable energy, simply even restricting ourselves to low-carbon energy sources. It is technically possible, whether at the UK level or the global level, to realise the transition that we need to undertake, technically, in ways that could be, if we account for them in terms of different infrastructures appropriately, entirely economic practices around nuclear power, or intercontinental renewable infrastructures, or carbon capture and storage, or centralised national renewables, or distributed energy services, provide the basis for effecting a transformation of that kind. There are others as well, if you look into geoengineering and so forth, but just looking at the energy infrastructures, we have these choices. We cannot and we will not do all of these things. We will do a restricted subset. We will probably optimise around one in the end, with other things mixing in only at the edges. And in a globalising world, the stakes get even higher because it's more difficult for individual parts of the world to do things in a more diverse fashion. Likewise, nanotechnology, similar things apply. I won't labour the point. But it plays out in biotechnology, in pharmaceuticals, agriculture, materials technology, and so forth at this point. So, what can we do about this? And this is my final part. First of all, then, I'm talking about broadening out the process of appraisal. So at the moment we have these possible pathways, and the way we appraise and the way society comes to understand them is revenge. Oh no, now you've seen my wonderful fool. We look at the different options that we have, and we appraise them in a relatively narrow fashion using risk assessment, cost-benefit analysis, or restricted forms of participatory process. And we get a picture like this, which appears to show a clear ordinal ranking, with precise and expressed. This is conveyed to policymaking as a unitary, sound, scientific, evidence-based, single, prescriptive recommendation. That then helps, through the governance process, to lock us in and reinforce the commitment to single pathways. Instead, what I'm saying is, I'm doing this graphic to make it clear what moving into innovation governance really means. It means broadening out, so using broader appraisal methods, thinking about uncertainty in a more mature way, looking at different options and comparing them, thinking about broader notions of performance, sustainability, for instance, rather than just safety, involving different perspectives, so broader in all those ways, in terms of the inputs. But it's also about the outputs, that we shouldn't pretend, no matter how broad we are, that we can crunch this out and analyse our way into a neat, tractable kind of puzzle where you just give one prescriptive recommendation to policy. It's about getting plural and conditional, explaining how it is so we can draw different conclusions about which is best, given different assumptions, different value judgments, which are equally valid. It's not anything goes, because a lot of things can be ruled out. A lot of pathways can be ruled out, but there will typically be a number of them that should be conveyed as a matter of responsibility to the governance process. And in turn, then, we should be more deliberate about a diversity of commitments in the pathways that we actually follow. So, final slide. To just summarise my main points, then, that it's a false dichotomy between rational risk science and emotive precaution and participation. All analysis and deliberation are framed and therefore equally shaped by values and interests. It's not possible to escape them. We should be open-eyed about that. That the language of pro and anti-technology and science is highly misleading, actually I would say quite corrosive, in that it takes our eye off this crucial fact, this crucial evidence about the way innovation and knowledge actually evolve over time. Undermines accountability and democracy in technology choice. That precaution, then, is not just about managing things in a different way, it's about broadening out the way we look at them, about being rigorous, scientifically rigorous, about uncertainty, ambiguity, and ignorance. And participation is not a panacea, because participation can be used through consensus conferences or citizens' jury verdicts to close down in the same way I'm critiquing here. It gives an artificially closed impression of the choices. But it can help to validate the different types of assumptions and interests and visions that we should be taking into account when we frame the science and ask the questions of science. So this opening up, then, means catalysing a more mature politics of technology, more reflexive, to use a social science jargon term, more aware of one's own positioning, as well as being more responsible, I would argue. And there are practical approaches to do this, ranging from the more explicit use, for instance, of sensitivity analysis, scenario analysis, participatory modelling, plural and conditional advice, where we actually ask science advisory committees to give us plural advice and explain why there are differences, rather than trying to bury it, as we heard very eloquently last night. So that, then, is my case for how we might hope to reconcile the apparently conflicting imperatives of science and democracy, precaution and progress, rationality and emotion. And this is my purple prose, so try and finish on a resounding note, but probably I'm anticipating it too much. But basically, we're talking about tensions around the Enlightenment project. Both democracy and science are products of the Enlightenment project, and they hold a lot of things in common. And what they hold in common is a recognition of the possibility of progress. And I think what we're doing now, in all these various ways, in different disciplines, thinking about progress, is understanding that progress isn't this one track, it's a multiplicity of choices. And that actually it's appropriate for the domain of social agency, a political agency, not just to be looking at how much or how fast along the given track, but about which way. And one might then refer to that as a kind of enablement, an enabling of a much more deliberate politics of progress. So, thank you very much.